Welcome to Mastering Logical Fallacies, the online course. This is the audio version of the online course presented at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. For the complete learning experience, including multimedia presentations, quizzes, assignments, peer-to-peer discussion, instructor interaction, and more, enroll as a student at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. My name is Beau Bennett, and I am your instructor for this course. In this lesson, we're going to be talking about the appeal to nature, the naturalistic fallacy, and the moralistic fallacy. These are all fallacies related to nature in some way. So first, let's talk about the appeal to nature. It's this idea that anything that is natural is good, and anything that is unnatural is bad. This is an obvious fallacy if we think about it, yet it persists in our culture because sometimes people could use this as a general heuristic and it might make sense in some circumstances, and we'll talk about that. First, I want to make it perfectly clear that things that are natural can be very bad for you, and things that are unnatural can be very good for you. Think of surgery, antibiotics, homes, pacemakers, solar panels. These are all man-made things, human-made things, and they're all very good for us and, in some cases, the environment, like solar panels. And think about things like lead, uranium, Ebola, flesh-eating bacteria, cocaine. These are all natural, not made by humankind. Yet, they are horrible for us and for life in general and the environment. So we can't just say that that which is natural is good and that which is unnatural is bad. That is completely fallacious in many different ways. So why do we do it? Why does this idea persist in our culture and in many cultures, actually? Well, let's look at ice cream for an example. And this is something that I'm guilty of as well. But it doesn't necessarily have to be fallacious. It really kind of borders the line, teeters the line between a reasonable heuristic and something that is actually fallacious. If you're shopping and you see two different ice cream containers and you want to buy some ice cream and you look at them and they both look good, they're both the same price, so you decide to look at the ingredients. One lists tons of ingredients that you cannot pronounce, that you don't know what they are. And there are many of them. And the other one lists just a few ingredients. Well, as a heuristic, again, a heuristic is just kind of a mental shortcut. As a heuristic, if you just take the one that has fewer ingredients, that might be a good idea. Why? Because statistically speaking, all those different ingredients are not going to help you in any way. They're not put there to improve your health. They're there for most likely to either preserve the product in some way or as a way for the producer to kind of save money in some of the production process or some of the ingredients. Now, none of those ingredients could actually be dangerous or harmful for you in any way. They don't have to be. And assuming that they are is fallacious and is just probably an incorrect assumption because it must have passed FDA approval and it's on the market and it's being used. So the idea is that they are potentially safe. The idea is, though, that each one of these products, each one of these additional ingredients could possibly have some unknown or long-term effect that we just don't know about it. So the more that you add onto the list, statistically speaking, the greater the chances that you could be ingesting one of these products that are potentially harmful. So with that in mind, it might not be a bad idea to pick the product that has the fewer number of ingredients. Okay, that is the baseline heuristic. Now, a problem with that theory or that whole idea, that heuristic, is that you can be choosing natural ingredients that are a lot worse for you than these benign ingredients that are not really good for you, but they're just not harmful for you either. So you could be picking the ice cream that has a heck of a lot more sugar than the other ice cream, because sugar is listed as a natural product as just one single product, but it could be overall worse for your health. So you could see that it's not a very simple evaluation. It's not a simple formula. It does take some thought, some knowledge about ingredients and chemistry and health and nutrition. But overall, you could see why people can cling to a certain heuristic, such as that which is natural is good for you and that which is unnatural is bad for you. So what exactly is natural? How could we define natural? Well, if we look it up, the dictionary says that natural is existing in or caused by nature, not made or caused by humankind. Okay, that might seem clear enough. It might seem like we can create two different categories, natural and unnatural. And we could take anything in the universe and throw it into one of those categories, definitely, and say, yeah, that definitely fits in there, or that definitely fits in that category. But that's not the case. That's not how it works. Natural, unnatural is a false dichotomy. What it really is it's a continuum with natural on one end and unnatural on the other. So for example, we could look at something, say like an automobile, and we could put that in the unnatural end of the spectrum, the continuum. And we could look at something, say like corn, and we can move it over to the natural end of the continuum. However, if we look closely at both of those different things that we threw at the different ends of the spectrum, we could see that it really isn't that crystal clear. For example, the car itself is made up of elements that are part of nature, that are found in nature. There is nothing in that car, nothing that you won't find somewhere in nature. And we're not talking about you're going to find a tire in nature, but we're talking about that the elements that go into making the tire you will find in nature. The car is essentially part of nature. It is natural in a sense, but it was just brought about by human intervention. And now let's look at corn. Really, you're not going to find corn naturally in nature without human intervention. Corn is a product of human manipulation. It just didn't exist before humans. It was in a very different form, and through crossbreeding and selection process, we were able to get the corn. And when I say we, I mean humankind over the last several hundred years. We were able to get the corn into the nice, delicious, sugary, plump product that it is today. And we could say the same thing about a lot of the vegetables and fruits that we have today. So just like the automobile, we're looking at things that existed in nature, but they had a lot of human interaction and human intervention to bring it about. So when you think of it in those terms, it's very unclear as to what is natural and what is not natural. And to look at this a little bit more from a philosophical perspective, we are part of the natural universe. We are part of the natural world. Just like a beaver is a part of nature and the natural world, the beaver creates a dam. Can we say that the dam is natural? Well, if we just go by the dictionary definition, it had nothing to do with humankind, but it was a product of the beaver. The beaver did the work and built the dam. So therefore, the dam is part of nature. So if we could say that, why are we taking us out of the natural picture? Why are we taking humankind? What makes us so special that we are so incredibly different from all other living beings on this planet? And we could say that we, the things that we create, are not part of nature. They're unnatural. That we have to recognize as an arbitrary distinction. And by recognizing it as an arbitrary distinction, we start to realize the fallaciousness of this whole natural-unnatural dichotomy. Next, I want to talk about this idea that I call the simplistic evaluation problem. It's this idea that when we're giving value to something that's natural or unnatural, and we're determining whether it's good or bad, what we're doing is we're really just considering the effects it has on our immediate health, and that's it, or our potential future health. We're not considering other effects that really do need to be considered when we normally evaluate things on a good or bad scale. When we do evaluate things as good or bad, we take into other considerations, such as the effects on the environment, the effects on other living organisms, the effects that it might have on a global scale, even the effects on the economy. These are all things that we take into consideration when we determine if something is actually good for us or bad for us. But when it comes to something that's natural or unnatural, for some reason, we don't tend to do that. We tend to just focus on this whole idea of personal health. Take, for example, genetically modified organisms. This is one of the big problems and the big arguments involved in the debate, is a lot of people will look at these, and for an issue we'll talk about next, they will say that these are potentially bad for us, so therefore we should ban them or not use them. But what they're failing to do is they're failing to evaluate these things on a global scale. How does it affect the economy? How does it affect other people who normally can't afford food? So while there may be some potentially unknown long-term negative effects, there are definitely present-term effects on being able to feed millions of people who otherwise couldn't eat. And this is something that generally goes ignored. And this could work both ways in the argument as well. Sometimes people will just look at the immediate economic effects that something may have, but they don't look at the potentially long-term or even the immediate environmental effects of a certain process. And therefore, they're just being very myopic in their vision of what is good or bad, and they're not looking at the whole picture. The last thing I wanted to talk about in relation to the appeal to nature is this idea that no evidence of harm equals bad versus positive evidence of no harm. So we can look at something like GMOs again. And I know this is a controversial topic, and I don't mean to take one side or another, but this is a good example, because one of the main arguments against GMOs is the idea that there could be, well, first of all, there's nothing extra in GMOs. GMOs is genetically modified organisms. It's a process. It's not something that's added into them. So we can argue, or somebody can argue, that this process can be potentially bad in some unknown way in the future. Again, that's something that we just don't know about yet. So we could test it left and right and put millions of dollars into testing into these things, and we could find absolutely nothing wrong with it. However, that doesn't mean that in the future or down the road, there could be some negative side effects. And that is a legitimate argument, but it's also fallacious in a way if we are associating this idea of unknown equal to bad. Because this is the way science works. There is no way we could test something and say that it is 100% safe and always will be. That's just not reasonable. It's not practical, because we never know what the future might bring. It's just like saying that we could test the sun and we could say that it's there now, right? But we can say that it's guaranteed it's going to be there tomorrow in that same position or close to it. We just don't know. I mean, there's no reason whatsoever, there's no evidence for us to suggest otherwise that the sun is not going to rise tomorrow, metaphorically speaking. But we cannot say with certainty that it will. So therefore, we don't say that this is a bad thing. We just say this is just the way nature works. This is the way science works, the naturalistic methodology of understanding the universe. So when we look at something like GMOs or anything that's that we may modify, and we claim that it's potentially harmful in the future, we have to look at what we have done to test if it's harmful now. And if adequate evidence exists that we tested something and we did not find anything, and there is absolutely no reason to believe there is any harm in this process or in this in ingredients, then we should take that at its value and not associate that with being bad. And finally, in this lesson, I want to talk about the naturalistic fallacy and the moralistic fallacy. These are inverses of each other, and they are different from the appeal to nature. The appeal to nature, if you recall, basically is assigning a good or bad type of judgment with something that's either natural or unnatural. The naturalistic fallacy, specifically, is the assumption that that which is found in nature is morally right. So we're not talking about good or bad judgments. We're talking about a moralistic judgment. We're talking about morality here, not something that's amoral. We talked about corn before. Corn is amoral. There's nothing moral about corn. But when we're talking about the naturalistic fallacy, we're talking about a moralistic attitude or behavior. One of the prime examples that's found in debate, which often refers to this fallacy, is the idea of homosexuality. Homosexuality not being natural. So if we say that it's not natural, therefore it is bad, well, this is fallacious, because there are plenty of behaviors and natural processes that we consider very immoral, that most people would agree are very immoral. For example, multiple sexual partners and polygamy. This is we're naturally attracted to multiple people, and this is just something that is part of our nature. But acting on that is something that we suppress. So we are suppressing nature, and that is considered moral by most standards. So the bottom line is, we can never say that which is natural is moral. We cannot make the connection. We cannot say that those two are connected. There could be things that are natural that are moral, but we can't say because it is natural, therefore it is moral. And that's the distinction. Now, the inverse of this is called the moralistic fallacy. And this is basically saying that which is moral must be natural. This is even more fallacious, because this is going against the way science and reason and basic knowledge works. We are starting with the conclusion that this X is moral. And then we're saying, okay, because we already presupposed that X is moral, then X must be natural. And we have to look for that in nature. So basically, it's a form of the confirmation bias. We've already come to the conclusion, and that's what we're looking for. An example of this, once again, is this idea of homosexuality and how it's immoral, therefore, it must not be found in nature. I have seen this argument so many times, people claiming that it's immoral, therefore it's unnatural. It's unnatural. But yet, homosexuality is found in over 1,500 species. And that's just where people were looking. I mean, it's probably everywhere. But yet, many people refuse to believe that, because they want to stick with this idea that it can't be natural because it's already immoral. Or in their minds, it's immoral. Therefore, it can't be natural. And this is just fallacious. It's fallacious in many different ways, because that's not the way the knowledge works and the scientific process works, nor is there any reasonable connection to say that that which is moral must be natural. So that is fallacious.